Support for Access Utah comes from the Utah Humanities Council, enriching cultural, intellectual, and civic life by providing opportunities for all Utahns to explore life's most engaging questions and the wonders of the human experience. Hello, welcome to Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden in Logan. We're taking your garden questions at 1-800-826-1495. Don't wait till the end of the program. Last week we had 7 questions, and they were kind of all bunched up at the end. So give us a call right now while you're thinking about it, 800-826-1495, or go online to upr.org, click on the Programs tab, and you'll see Access Utah and can email us your question. Mark, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. Thank you.
In the opening to the program, I talked about lettuce and leafy greens and getting all of those in right now. So let's talk specifics. One of the things, now this is just a personal something that I prefer not growing, but I just say no to iceberg every time I get a chance because I like, there's no flavor to the things, and you never get the nice big head that you're looking for usually.
Right.
And so I go for all these leafy greens that come up so much quicker, and I can cut them back and get more. You can't do that with the head of the lettuce.
We don't even sell iceberg at the store, so it just doesn't do that well. So, and it doesn't have as much nutrient value as a lot of the other lettuces. So I'd have to say for some of our favorite varieties, of course, the Butter Crunch is still one of my favorites. I've got a heat-resistant variety that's called Esmeralda, which is a heat-tolerant Butter Crunch, and it forms up those nice, perfect butter heads that are so expensive at the grocery store. So that's a really nice one. Romaine's. The Romaine's also full of nutrient, really quick growers. You can get loose heads off of those, kind of like you do with the Butter Crunch. Plato and Outback are two very heat-tolerant varieties that we carry that are excellent. There's a lot of different varieties of romaine out there. We've got a really nice red romaine also. Have you ever tried that one?
I haven't done a red romaine.
Yeah,
I like to do a lot of the leafy reds.
Yeah,
but
I've got a red romaine that's really good also. So it's a little sweeter than some of the other red leaf lettuces. Of course, we sell a ton of our mixture that has a little bit of everything in it.
So a mesclun mix.
Yeah, it's got Butter Crunch. It's got some Simpson in it. It's got romaines in it. It's got a couple of red leaf, and it's a really nice
Those
mix.
Are always kind of nice because you just kind of, usually, at least in our family, we like to have a whole mixture anyway.
Oh, yeah.
So why not just mix the seeds together and put them
just
in the row? And
harvest it as it comes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that works really well. I'd have to say the Simpson Elite is probably the best Simpson that we've used. So it's a real fine textured, almost a lime colored. I mean, it's a really light green colored lettuce. It can almost look yellow sometimes, but it's a really really nice texture, good flavor to it. So that's a nice one. So the Simpson Elite's a little bit more heat tolerant as well too. And then probably for some of the head lettuces, Summertime is excellent. Summertime also a little more heat tolerant. With the heat tolerant varieties, you'll get an extra 3 or 4 weeks probably out of them. If it turns really, really hot quickly, you'll maybe get an extra couple weeks out of it, but still with the greens, that's a couple extra weeks that you wouldn't get otherwise.
Do you end up sacrificing any flavor with the heat resistant ones?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think they're equally as good, flavor wise, and instead of just bolting as soon as it starts to warm up, they continue producing. So we can usually get ours to last through the first or middle part of July without too much trouble.
Yeah, I really hate that. You go out there and you're just going along and you're getting a lot of leafy greens, and then you see the little spiral starting to form in the middle and push up, and like, oh no, don't bolt.
And it just kind of goes bitter after that.
Yeah.
It's just not as good. So I'd have to say that's probably it for the lettuces. Some very good spinach varieties. Corenta is a flat leaf. It's kind of they call it a semi-savoy, but it's not as crinkly, and it's much easier to wash, and it's got very, very good flavor, and again, quite heat-tolerant. And we also, we really like Melody. The Melody's got just a refined, nice flavor to it.
And that's a crinkle one?
That's a really crinkly one. But flavor-wise, it doesn't have that harsh iron taste to it. It's just a really mellow spinach, so it's very, very good. So those can all go in right now. Of course, you can do radishes, peas, onions, cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli, turnips, and then all your leafy greens, you know, spinaches and lettuces. And I've had a lot of people doing collards and corn salad and, you know, all that stuff. It can handle the cold. You know, whatever Mother Nature has to throw at us in the next month or 6 weeks, you know, however long spring lasts.
Now, I had this little window last Saturday. I thought, okay, so for me, I got all the leaves on the garden, but I couldn't get them tilled in. So I thought, oh no, this is going to be a late spring for me getting the ground thawed and dry.
And dry.
Because I have a lot of clay.
Yeah.
But the back half of the garden didn't get quite as many leaves as the front half. So I went back Saturday and I went, oh, I might be able to get the tiller in here. Yeah. So I got the tiller out. It was actually really quite good.
Good.
So then I thought, okay, I've got a storm coming in. I kept looking off to the west and seeing the dark clouds, and it was headed that way. I'm going to try this. So I came, got seeds, quickly started planting, and dang if I didn't get most everything in that I wanted to get in.
Great.
So I got some parsnips. I planted those, put in, of course, some peas, lettuce, spinach, arugula. What else did I try? Oh, onions. And so I planted onions from seed. And so I'm hoping that with consistent moisture, I'll be looking pretty good.
Well, we had almost 10 days of nice, dry, warm weather. And so we were able to get the soil dried out. And if anyone had any snow left over, that got all melted off. And things were able to dry out enough for, I think, a lot of people to get out and get their soil turned over and plant a few things. So, and it looks like, you know, we've got a little wet storm system that's come through this weekend and maybe a little bit more today, but then looks like we've got some nice weather again for next weekend, so maybe you'll be able to plant a few more things.
Well, and I tilled extra so I could get that ground dried out a little bit
dried
faster
out a little
next
bit
time.
Faster. Yeah. That's good.
Well, join our conversation. Our toll-free number is 800-826-1495. Or go online to upr.org and click on the programs tab for Access Utah. So looking at the leafy greens, are there always new varieties that are coming out, or do you see the older standbys be ones that you tend to go for?
You know, some years there's new things that come out, and other years nothing. And so I would say for the last year or two, I haven't seen too much, you know, groundbreaking new stuff that's come out in a lot of the earlier crops. But of course, there's always new varieties that come out every year, and we get to sample a lot of things and see what we like. But you know, there's a lot of great old standbys that are just, I mean, they've been around for 50, 60 years, some of them even longer, that are just, they're just really good. And the prices are good on them, and it's hard to beat. You know, like we were talking lettuces earlier, you know, good old Butter Crunch is just, it's just hard to beat. And we still sell a lot of Great Lakes, which is kind of a head-forming variety, which is still really good. And Red Sails, and I mean, there's a lot of great ones that are still out there. And Salad Bowl. We put Salad Bowl in our mixture, so that's a good one. That's a really nice one, too. Bloomsdale Spinach, and, you know, some of these varieties, I guess, would be classified as heirlooms now, because they've been around for so long, yeah. And we still have a lot of customers coming in, you know, asking specifically for heirloom varieties, and it's really hard to inform them that, you know, all these varieties that we've been selling for the last 70 years since we've been open. I mean, some of these varieties we've been selling since we opened the store. I mean, they're heirloom varieties, but I mean, we've been selling them for that long. It's just a good variety that's been around for a while. So in a lot of cases, there's nothing really special or unique about a lot of the varieties that are being touted as heirlooms. It's just they're good varieties that have been around for a long time, and you know, nothing spectacular has really come out to replace them. So
there's nothing like doing your own testing.
Yeah.
I've been doing some testing with cucumbers the last couple of years, and there was an All-America winner that came out a couple of years ago called Diva that I just love it.
It's a good one.
I used to do the market more, and is that a slicer?
Yeah.
Yeah, I used to do the market more, and it's still a good one. Mm-hmm. In my garden, Diva just went crazy.
Goes like crazy.
But as far as the beans, Blue Lake, every time I've tried something else, I've gone right back to the Blue Lake.
It's still good, yeah. So some of those older varieties are just you know, tried and true and just keep on going. So I'd have to say in the cucumbers, the Orient Express is my favorite. So.
Is that a new one or is it a...
It's been around for probably 4 or 5 years, maybe a little bit longer, but it's a long, skinny, burpless style. So the Diva's more like your Market More, you know, it's a 7-8 inch long cucumber, and the Orient Express is more of a 10 to 12 inch long cucumber, and real skinny, very small seed cavity. it's really good.
So. Well, it's pretty amazing what they've been able to come out with the last few years. Like with the Diva, I think they're supposed to be all female Blossoms.
Yeah.
And it's like, how are they able to breed this into the plant?
Yeah.
And so you just try a little bit, see what's going on. Now, with a lot of the leafy greens, if you wanted to, since they're not hybrids, you can grow them, let them bolt and go to seed,
yeah,
and plant them again the next year.
You could.
Or if you're like me, you just don't till a certain area and they come up on their own anyway.
Yeah, you sure could. A lot of varieties are difficult to harvest the seed on. Especially, you know, like cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli,
yeah,
where they're biennials, and a lot of your root crops are as well too. So carrots and beets and chard, you've got to let those winter over, and then they won't go to seed until the next year. So some of them are kind of a little tricky to try and do that.
So when I have Swiss chard coming up every year, it's from seed from plants I did 2 years ago?
The Swiss chard is biennial, so it'll actually winter over and come back the next spring.
Okay.
But in many cases, it will just kind of go to seed, and it's not as good flavor-wise, quality-wise, as it was the year before. And so you have to, if you want to harvest the seed on it, you have to let it winter over and then come up again the next year. And that's how you get it to go to seed.
That will explain where I got those from last year. Bright Lights is a chard.
Yeah, that's a really good one. So we kind of classify the chard and the carrots and the parsnips and potatoes in like our second planting category. So we'll kind of shoot for the first part of April, you know, maybe around Easter time to plant those. We like a little bit warmer soil, but it's kind of interesting. We drove down to Salt Lake this weekend, and there's leaves on the willow trees already. Ready, which last year didn't happen until like end of April. So we're 4 weeks ahead of last year
easily. I had a listener last week from Beaver Dam, Arizona, sent me a photo he had taken 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Of apricots in bloom.
Oh yeah,
it was nuts.
I don't think ours are too far behind. I think we'll be a couple of weeks, and we could have blossoms on some of the trees. So
I'm certainly seeing the buds swelling.
Yeah, yeah. So if you have fruit trees, you better get out there and get some pruning done. And definitely after you get done pruning, make sure and get your dormant oil and possibly a fungicide mixed in with it applied to your trees before it gets too late, because things are moving along much quicker this year. Soil's much warmer. Air temperatures are warmer.
About time.
About time. It's, you know, we haven't had 3 feet of snow on the ground all winter long, and so things are starting to move along much quicker, and it's been 3 seasons that we haven't had this. So this is like the fourth year that finally we're starting to get a fairly earlier spring.
Is there something new that you've been wanting to try that maybe you haven't done, or something in the last couple of years that, because of the coolness, have kept you from doing it, that you've wanted to try?
Sweet potatoes. I've had a lot of people the last couple of years that have really wanted to do sweet potatoes. So we brought them in 2 years ago, and it was just a disaster because it was so cold. I mean, the ground was so cold and so wet, and they really don't do well unless your soil's warmer, and we just haven't had that.
So would you put them like in a planter or something? Is that something
you,
that would...
You could. Best thing to do is to kind of hill your soil up, you know, so you have not necessarily a really big mound, but you want to hill it up maybe 6 or 8 inches and plant them right in the middle of that, because the hills will kind of warm up quicker than the main part of your soil. And if you can put black plastic or weed barrier down a couple of weeks before you plant them to heat the soil up, that really helps as well too. But, you know, last year our soil was just so cold and wet until, you know, middle of June even, that a lot of very heat-sensitive plants like the sweet potatoes just did not do well. I mean, I don't know how your tomatoes were, but ours were like 3 weeks behind schedule.
Well, it took me forever to get them in.
Yeah, yeah.
So
for one.
Think I lucked out a little bit, because they were smaller when I finally got them put in.
Yeah.
And I didn't get the production out of them that I wanted,
right.
But I don't think I could have gotten anything else anyway.
We were still getting tomatoes by the first or middle part of August, but usually it's the latter part of July.
Yeah.
And you know, for the bulk of our tomatoes to come on, I mean, it was into September before they really were going. And it just kind of puts a crimp on things when you're trying to bottle tomatoes and freeze corn and beans and things like that. It just pushed the season back so far, as everything was all coming on at the same time, and it was difficult, I think, for a lot of people to get their produce put away for the season.
My dad mentioned that he had two crops of corn,
mm-hmm.
and the second one that he planted 3 weeks after the first actually passed up the first crop and was like regular, where the first crop, it just remained kind of stunted. It was nice as well. It's because it got damaged by the cold.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, it was just so cold. So hopefully we will have a little bit more average spring this year. I mean, we'll have periods where we're going to have some cold, wet weather, obviously. I mean, it's Utah, it's Cache Valley. I mean, we're used to that. But we will hopefully get some periods of nice warm weather in between that as well, too, to allow us to get out and do some planting and, you know, get things done as well, which we just haven't had the opportunities to do the last couple of years. So we'll see what happens. Onion plants are coming in this week, too. So
Okay, well, let's talk about onions. And you can get them, of course, seed, which is how I planted them. You can get them in sets, which are, they've been grown for like a year, and so that
not even a year. I'd say they probably started them late last summer, early last fall, let them get to a certain size. So they're not even golf ball size. They're smaller. They're like nickel size. Maybe the biggest ones would be like the size of a quarter, you know, around. And you plant those, and just in a short couple weeks, you've got green onions coming up. I mean, they're very, very quick.
But then you have the onions that aren't quite, they're not hard. It's like they've just been grown a little bit.
Yep. And then we've got the onion plants that come in from one of our growers, and they are the best varieties that we carry. So we've got like Dolce Grande and Big Daddy Candy, Red Candy Apple, Red Zeppelin, and Walla Walla is what we'll have this year. And they are probably 3-month-old plants, and you can transplant those out, and they'll just take off. I mean, they'll just continue growing. They're already growing right now. We're just going to plant those, and they'll just, you know, continue doing their thing. That's when you get the biggest onions. You get those really large onions out of the plants.
Now, it seems like with the sets, the harder bulbs that you put in, I was always struggling with them thinking, okay, it's my second year, and now it's trying to put out seed head.
Yep.
And so you don't get quite as big. So that's why I like these plants that have just been grown for a couple of months.
Or to do them from seed. So if you're doing them from seed, or if you're doing, you know, the green live plants, then you tend to not see the center split as much. You don't see them go to seed as much, even though they can still go to seed in the middle of summer. And the bulbs tend to get larger in the fall, and they'll also keep better. The sets are really convenient, though, because they're easy. You can just stick them in the ground. They turn into green onions really quickly. You still get pretty good-sized onions out of them that keep well. It's just if you do them from seed, they will keep better, and they'll probably grow larger.
So maybe you do a little bit of both, so you have onions a little bit more quick.
Yeah, and the sets are, you know, if you're a novice gardener and you're just doing it for the first time, the sets are about as easy as it gets. I mean, because you can just plop those in.
That's how I started.
Yeah, a couple weeks later, you've got green onions going. I mean, it's a very, if your thumb's not green, that's a great way to start.
Isn't it interesting how that does sort of run in families as far as interests are concerned, and some people discover it a little bit later in life. Like my dad never grew a garden or did anything until he retired, and then all of a sudden, boom, he's growing left and
he
right.
He really liked it, yeah. I think it's kind of inherent in our genetics to want to grow things.
It passed from grandma to my mom to me.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. I really think it is. And there's a lot of people that once they catch that bug, it's a hard one to break, because it's just rewarding and fun to watch things grow and see what they produce, and you just want to do it again the next year.
It's like having your own kids and watching, of course,
almost.
You're eating them, but
almost
kind
of
a, not quite the right metaphor, but it is something that you get fairly immediate satisfaction.
Oh yeah, for sure, and it's really fun. I think people that work the soil and you know, grow gardens, they're not afraid to get dirty, they're not afraid to work, and they tend to be really, really honest, hardworking, good people, because they know what it takes to watch the progress. And I mean, it takes work, it takes patience, it takes time, and that's the kind of person that you develop by growing in the garden. So
our toll-free number, we'd love to have your conversation, your question with our conversation, 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or online at upr.org. Click on the Programs tab and email us an Access Utah question. Now, I did have a question from last week. We didn't quite know how to answer it. And I've been trying to do some research on this, but we had a caller who was wondering how to get magnesium back into the soil.
Yeah.
She'd been doing some research that showed that magnesium levels had been depleted quite a bit. So are there any plants or a cover crop that would put magnesium back into the soil?
Not that I'm aware of. Magnesium is essential for plants that are producing flowers. It really encourages bloom. And so the magnesium is great for roses especially, but anything that's producing flowers, especially flowering shrubs, it's great to keep them blooming and looking really good. Epsom salts, magnesium sulfate is the best source of magnesium. I don't know of any cover crops that would put that kind of nutrient back in. Some of the
Epsom salts. It's just like they're soaking their feet, their roots.
Yeah, pretty close. Okay. Yeah. So we use magnesium sulfate, which is the same thing as Epsom salts, and it's a little bit less expensive. So we carry it in like 4-pound bags. It's fairly easy to do. There's a really neat mineral supplement that's called azomite, which is a natural mineral supplement. I'm not sure where it's derived from, but it carries a lot of these micronutrients and minerals and puts them back into your soil. And it's a product that came out just a couple of years ago, at least that I'm aware of. It may have been around a lot longer, but we've heard about it about 3 years ago or so. And it's fairly inexpensive, covers a pretty good size area, and it really will build the mineral and the micronutrient content of your soil back up. And the other thing that we recommend would be soil activator, the Humate. The Humate's got a lot of minerals and micros in it as well, too. So not a lot of major nutrients. You're not going to see a lot of nitrogen, phosphorus, or potassium in there, but a lot of carbon and magnesium and boron and copper. I mean, all the micros and the minerals that are really essential for your plants as well, too.
How familiar are you with different manures? So everything from, I'm just wondering if maybe there might be something in manure.
Yeah.
I don't usually put my chicken manure on the garden until it's really well composted.
Not real,
it's kinda hot.
Yeah, not real high in the micros. Depends on what they're eating. Yeah, it depends on what they're eating. So I would say the best one that's out there, the very, very best manure that you could possibly get is bat guano. It's got more nutrient in it than anything else that's out there, bar none. I don't know if it's because of their food source, because they're eating a lot of bugs and stuff, but just much, much higher in nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. Mm. And it's really an amazing one.
So where do you get that unless you happen to live next to Carlsbad Caverns?
Yeah, Carlsbad. You go up to Logan Cave and you get some out
you
up there.
You can't get in there.
I know. They've blocked it off. Can't even get in there anymore. So we actually have a couple different fertilizers that we use that have bat guano in them. And I do have smaller bags. I think it's like a 2-pound bag of the bat guano, but definitely much higher in nutrient value than most other manures. Now, when it comes to steer manure, really organic fertilizers are really slow to break down, and so you don't have to have as high of an analysis on the nutrient for the organic fertilizers because they're water insoluble, and so it takes a long time for them to become soluble in the water so that the plants can really pick them up and
use them. So they slowly release
it. So they release really, really slowly and very consistently over a long period of time. If you're using something like you said, like a poultry manure, like a chicken or a turkey, it does have a pretty decent nitrogen source in there, but it's generally the urea that's in there, and in many cases there's some other stuff in there that's causing it to be really hot, so it'll really burn your plants very quickly. So you don't have to use a lot of it, but it's best if you can work it in, a small amount into a larger, to a deeper depth in your soil, and you won't have that particular problem. Or try and work it in the fall so it'll break down through the wintertime, and then it'll be less harsh on your plants in the springtime, and that should help quite a bit as well too. So I tend to stay away from the steer manure because it brings in so many diseases. I mean, there's diseases that not affect you necessarily but affect the plants. So you've got scab on potatoes is almost directly related to manure brought in, and then you can very easily get fusarium and verticillium wilt through the steer manure that can affect your tomatoes and your peppers and squashes and melons and things like that. So try and stay away from the steer manure unless it's really well composted, and then it won't be as much of a problem. The poultry manure tends to be less likely to bring those types of diseases in. But when it comes to all your manures, you got to be really careful if you're using fresh stuff with E. coli and salmonella, and make sure and wash your fruit and vegetables really well before you use them.
Well, and that would explain also why you see the farmers spreading it on their fields fairly early, even over the snow, so it has time to break down a little bit.
Yep. And you know, a lot of the farmers, if they're growing, you know, corn, it's not as big of an issue. You know, the corn's a real heavy nitrogen feeder, so they can put the manure on a lot heavier and, you know, work that in. And then, you know, the ears are 3 feet up off the ground. It's not an issue when you're picking it. But I know that's where a lot of the outbreaks of salmonella and E. coli have happened the last few years, is in farms that have been using a lot of manure and they just haven't got washed and cleaned properly. Mm-hmm. And that's where a lot of that's been coming from. So,
well, we've reached the halfway point of our program. We're going to listen to the next segment of Wild About Utah and then be back with Mark Anderson for the rest of the hour. Call in with your questions at 800-826-1495 or go to upr.org.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Holly Strand of Stokes Nature Center in beautiful Logan Canyon. The Colorado River is the largest waterway in the Southwest. 1,450 miles long, the Colorado River Basin drains 248,000 square miles in 7 large western states. In Utah, the river enters Cisco south of I-70, winds its way through Arches and Canyonlands National Parks, then flows through Glen Canyon and exits south into Arizona. Less than 100 years ago, the Colorado River wasn't in Utah or even in Colorado. Until 1920, Colorado River referred only to the river section downstream from Glen and Grand Canyons. Upstream, it was called the Grand River, all the way up to the headwaters in the Colorado Rockies. Thus, we have Grand Canyon in Utah and the town of Grand Junction in Colorado. According to Jack Schmidt, professor in Utah State University's Department of Watershed Sciences and a longtime scholar of the river, the good citizens of the state of Colorado weren't pleased with the Colorado River's location. So in 1920, the Colorado legislature renamed Colorado's portion of the Grand River with a somewhat awkward result. The Colorado River began in Colorado, became the Grand River at the border with Utah, and then became the Colorado River again at the confluence with the Green. This arrangement did not last long, again because of a Colorado legislator. U.S. Representative Edward T. Taylor petitioned the Congressional Committee on Interstate and Foreign Commerce to rename the entire river as the Colorado. Despite objections from Utah and Wyoming representatives and the U.S. Geological Survey, the name change was made official by the U.S. Congress on July 25, 1921. The objections were legitimate. In the 1890s, the Federal Board on Geographic Names established the policy of naming rivers after their longest tributary. The former Grand River of Colorado and Utah was shorter than the Green River tributary by quite a bit, so the Green River should have prevailed and the Colorado should have been one of its tributaries. However, if you judge tributary primacy by volume, the Colorado wins hands down. 100 years ago, the Upper Colorado, or former Grand River, had a significantly higher total flow than the Green. But what's in a name? Prior to widespread European settlement, the Grand River was also known as the Rio Rafael, and before that, different parts of the river had numerous Native American and Spanish names. 1,000 years from now, the Colorado could have an entirely different identity. The main thing is that Utahns can enjoy and appreciate the habitat, scenery, and many resources that this important waterway provides. Thanks to the USU College of Natural Resources and the Rocky Mountain Power Foundation for supporting research and development of this Wild About Utah topic. For Wild About Utah and Stokes Nature Center, I'm Holly Strand.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah comes from the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Information is at cnr.usu.edu.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches. Hello, welcome back to the second half of Access Utah today. Mark Anderson from Anderson's Seed and Garden is in studio, and we would appreciate your questions or comments at 1-800-826-1495 or go online to upr.org, click on the Programs tab, and send us an Access Utah question that way. Mark, I did have a question a couple of weeks ago, and I'm hoping I gave him the right answer, but someone wanted to cut down a willow. And I've talked with my neighbor because there's been some willows that were planted by a previous neighbor to his owner, to his property. And these willows, they just grow so fast. And the roots just run everywhere. And he's discovered that they're going into his hydrant there at the back that gets water. They've had to dig it up and replace it already.
Yeah.
And the roots are headed into my garden, even though there's a ditch between me and them. And I want to get these things out.
Sure.
So what I suggested was we need to cut the tree down and immediately treat the stump with something like Roundup. But you are suggesting, as we talked in the middle of the program, in the break, something a little bit stronger.
Yeah. And the Roundup or the glyphosate works just fine. But in many cases, a stronger broadleaf weed killer, you know, something like you'd use on your lawn, works the best, and in many cases is less expensive also than the Roundup. So the one that we like the best is called Brush and Stump Killer, and it has triclopyr in it. And you can use it for weeds in your lawn, but you just use it undiluted on the fresh stump. And usually I'll take a small container or Dixie cup or something, and you know, just pour a little bit in there. Of course, you don't want to wear gloves. And I'll take an old paintbrush, and I'll just paint it right on the fresh cut of the stump, especially down the sides. You have the stump that's still exposed, and within 3 to 4 weeks, you'll have a completely dead root system. It'll just be absorbed right down in the root system. Take that entire plant out, so you don't have problems with the root system coming.
So you won't
back.
Have to cut again and put another application
no,
on.
No, just the one application will do it. And willows and poplars, especially when you cut them down, they will just send suckers all over the place. So if you do not treat the stumps right away, you'll have a million of them coming back.
Mm.
Which is not what you want.
Does this work for any tree or mostly the fast-growing kind?
Yeah, it'll work on any type of tree. So the Brush and Stump Killer, like I said, is probably my favorite because it's very consistent. I mean, it doesn't work really quickly, but it penetrates all the way down through the root system. So it's very, very effective, and you don't have to worry about little suckers popping up. I mean, one application and it will be gone.
So even with aspens,
even with aspens, but unfortunately, the root systems are kind of intermingled in the aspen,
yeah.
And you got to be really careful. If you kill one out, you might have some others that don't look so happy. Yeah, they don't look so happy.
Well, we have our first caller. We have Barbara from North Logan. Hi, Barbara. How can we help?
Hi, I just wanted to add something to your lettuce conversation a little bit earlier, and especially in the bolting thing. But I started planting my lettuces along my cottage garden fences because I found that in the escapee lettuces that bolted, the seeds are loved by the goldfinches.
Oh,
it's kind
perfect.
Of neat to see them come into your garden, you know, and we try to plant more for wildlife and that, and they'll eat those seeds. But, you know, I have regular beds of lettuce, but the stuff along the edges I just left bolt, and it was amazing to see the goldfinches, you know, 30 or 40 at a time coming into the yard and feeding off of this.
Oh, that's great.
I also have rabbits. So if you keep rabbits, the greenery on that stem you can also use to feed them. And even though you're not eating it, you know, you can get kind of a second crop out of it for, you know, a different animal.
For the bunnies,
but
yeah.
The goldfinch thing was totally a surprise to me, and it was an accident that those plants stayed where they were, but a real pleasant surprise and fun to see in the garden.
Barbara, that reminds me, for whatever reason, the tradition is handed down from grandpa to me to always have sunflowers in my garden, and I planted sunflowers once, the big heads, and I haven't planted since on my own. They just kind of keep coming back, but the chickadees absolutely go crazy over those little sunflowers that keep popping up. I never get the big heads again, but so
and
that sounds like a great thing.
They just hang on them and wave in the wind, and they just don't give up.
Yep.
So I love the lettuce idea.
Yeah. It's a nice way to reuse it, so something else can benefit.
Great. Thanks, Barbara.
Yep. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye. And that also reminded when she said she plants it along the edge. I had some lettuce last year that I planted more toward the west side of my garden where there's a little bit more shade, and it seemed to extend the season a little bit longer because it didn't get the heat of the day.
Yeah. If you can give it like a little bit of afternoon shade, that it will last a lot longer. It's that hot afternoon sun that really causes things to go to seed quickly. So it will help.
I wanted to ask you about implements in the garden. And again, this is coming. I need to get a shovel.
Yeah.
And I don't want to necessarily buy an inexpensive shovel. I want a good shovel that's going to last me a long time. So what do I look for when I'm buying a shovel?
There's a lot of different shovels out there. Of course, there's some very, very inexpensive shovels that aren't very good. And there's some average price shovels that are actually really pretty good. But if you're going to get one that's going to last for 20 years or longer, I've actually seen some of our customers come in that have had a certain shovel head for 30 years, and they've replaced the handle, you know, multiple times, and they're still good. The forged heads are actually forged out of one piece of thick steel.
Because you can see on the back of some of them, it looks like they've got the little V-shaped part of metal that's been tacked
onto.
Yeah,
so there's a open back shovel, which you can actually see the handle sticking out of the back of the shovel, and that's usually not a forged shovel. That's a stamped steel shovel, and so much less expensive, you know, easier to do. They'll just heat the steel up and they'll just put it in a machine. It just, you know, stamps it out, and here's your shovel head. You know, those usually like 16 gauge steel is what it would be, and they're fairly inexpensive, and you can get them with fiberglass or with wood handles. And of course, the fiberglass will last a little bit longer, but they'll eventually break as well too. When you get a forged shovel, there's no even welded little triangle on the back. Sometimes they'll do a reinforced shovel and they'll take a stamped one and then they'll weld that little piece on the back, so it kind of closes the back up, but then it also reinforces that joint as well too, so you have a little bit stronger shovel that way. But the forged ones, there's not even a piece welded there. It's just, you can tell that where the handle goes into the socket, the socket just turns into solid steel the rest of the way through. And it's usually a much heavier shovel. It's not one that I recommend for some of my smaller, more female customers, because it's a pretty heavy shovel, and you get dirt in it, and it's a workout running that shovel. But I've had mine since we built our house 16 years ago, and with a fiberglass handle on it. And it's got, you know, a couple rusty spots on it where I left it out and it got wet and, you know, it's rusted a little bit. But that shovel's going to last at least another 16, if not another 25 years. I'd be surprised. I mean, it's in great shape.
I do like the fiberglass handles because I tend to work in my garden without gloves.
Yeah.
And that's kind of stupid sometimes, but I just like the feel of no gloves.
Yeah.
So the fiberglass handle certainly makes it a lot easier not getting little slivers.
Definitely much easier. Yeah, definitely much easier. Have you tried the nitrile gloves?
I haven't. Tell me about the nitrile.
You should
gloves.
Try the nitrile gloves because they're really, really thin, and it feels like you don't have gloves on, but breathable on the back, so it's kind of a knit fabric, real thin fabric that the nitrile's been. The gloves have actually been dipped in the nitrile, and so your palms and your fingers have the nitrile grip on them, and then you've got just a mesh back on.
It doesn't make them sweaty?
Well, all gloves will make your hands kind of sweaty, but they breathe a lot better because of the mesh, and the nitrile's really tough, and it's wonderful for helping with blisters and stuff too. I've dug fence posts and planted trees and done all kinds of stuff with leather gloves, and much less likely to get blisters with the nitrile ones than I ever was with the leather ones.
Now, part of my problem has been, and I never thought I had that large a hand, but it's hard for me to find gloves that are usually big enough around the fingers.
The fingers.
Length is usually okay.
Yeah.
but it's going around the fingers.
Yep,
so
yep.
How do these?
These stretch really well. In fact, you want them a little bit tight, so you want to wear them a little on the tight side. But you have great dexterity with these gloves. I mean, you can pick up things just as if you didn't have gloves on. So very, very nice and durable. Usually I'll go through a pair, maybe two, a year, because they don't hold up like the leather ones do. But the advantages of these gloves are they're much less expensive. Instead of spending $20 for a pair of heavy duty leather ones, you're only spending $5 or $6 for these nitrile ones, and they wear really well. They breathe really well. They're washable. You can just throw them in the washer if they start to get sweaty and stinky. Just throw them in the washer. They're good for the next time. And I get fewer blisters with them.
So the test for me will be using them to weed with, because that's like my one chore that I just absolutely won't wear gloves for, because I can put my finger around that weed and pull it straight up, especially those stupid
weeds. You'll actually have better grip with these than you would without them.
Yep. And then you'll get dirt sliding off,
shoved up underneath your fingernails.
Yeah, there's the dirt shoving off. I usually get this callus on the outside of my pointer finger on my right hand.
You'll still get the callus, but the gloves will really help a lot. So the I would highly recommend the Nitro gloves. And they come in, of course, in lovely floral colors for the ladies, but they come in blue and black for the guys, too.
So. A little more manly color.
Yeah, a little more manly color.
Well, we have our next caller, and we have Phil in Logan. Hi, Phil. How can we help?
How you doing? I planted a Chicago fig tree last year and covered it in the fall, and I'm wondering when I should uncover it.
Good question. We usually recommend our rose gardeners that they wait until about the first or second weekend in April to uncover their roses. And I've had a lot of people the last week or so coming in just saying, I'm going to do my roses. Like, no, don't do your roses. We've got cold weather that's going to come, and then all of a sudden this week, here we have the cold weather. I would give it another week or two. Probably that first week in April, you'll probably be safe enough to uncover that and get things going. I would kind of treat it like the rose bushes.
Thank you.
I think that should work out really well. We want the soil to be a little bit warmer, but we still want to give it a little bit more protection, because we could get some cold, nasty weather still in the next couple of weeks. So.
Okay, very good. Right. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
Phil. Bye-bye. Our toll-free number is 800-826-1495. We only have about 9 minutes left in the program. 800-826-1495 or online at upr.org. Click on the program link for the Access Utah email link. Figs. I've never thought about growing figs in Cache Valley. So obviously they grow. This gentleman's got one.
Not very well.
They don't grow very well.
No, they're just not hardy enough. So we'll see. They may have made it through this year, but there's just nobody that has a large fig trees around here.
So if you're able to get it growing, I would think it's like my boysenberry, for instance.
Yeah.
I do get it overwintered, but I never get anything off of it because it's just too cold.
There's a lot of trees that are kind of marginal here that everyone really likes to grow, but we have limited success with sometimes, like magnolias and gardenias for sure. I've always got people who want to try gardenias, and they just get a couple of years out of them maybe, and that's about it. And
now, there are some magnolias. The star magnolias tend to do.
If you're in the
better.
Right spot, and there's a lot of new varieties of magnolias that are much hardier, but a lot of the old fashioned ones, the only ones that were in the valley were below the university, below the temple, in some really well protected microclimates. And same thing with dogwoods. There's not a lot of dogwoods around, but I actually have one at my house that has been going for probably 8 years now. If the deer would leave it alone, it would do fine.
I gave a Coosa dogwood to my mom because it was recommended by the forestry extension specialist, and it keeps coming back, but the deer
just massacre it. Yeah. So I've got a Coosa too, and when it blooms, it is gorgeous. But some years the blossoms all get frozen, and if the blossoms don't get frozen, then the deer eat them all off. And it's a tough tree to keep going and keep alive. So.
How do they survive the deer in the East where they're growing all the time. Maybe there's just so many of them.
There must be plenty for them to eat or something. But there's a lot of things that we would love to be able to grow. Just can't get them to stay alive that long. Kind of like a tender perennial, like a rosemary. You know, some years you can get them to come and they'll do just fine. And then next winter, they're just kick the bucket and just can't keep it alive for that long. So
I am excited because I was given a big pot of rosemary by a gentleman in Hyde Park who's now since moved. And I haven't gotten white fly or anything on it. It's coming along. There's been a south window, but I'm getting excited to stick it outside.
That's great. That's great. So, you know, it probably would have wintered over really well this year if you kept it outside. This is one of those winters where things will come through very nicely. Where last year, we had 60-70% rose loss, and I mean, it was a hard, hard, harsh winter, and it just seemed like it lasted forever. It was really hard on a lot of plants.
Now, something else that this gentleman gave me was this huge aloe vera plant.
Yeah,
I've never seen an aloe vera plant in blossom, and about 2 weeks ago, I noticed what it looked like a blossom. Now I've got a spike about 2.5 feet tall.
Yeah, very cool.
Does that mean I'm going to lose my plant? It's not like a century plant, is it, where it blossoms and then dies?
No, you won't have any problems with it. So
okay,
yeah, it should be fine.
So I'm just fortunate to have one big enough to blossom. Is that what it is?
Yeah, and if the conditions are right, they'll bloom. So, yeah, I haven't seen it a whole lot, but from what I've read, the size doesn't really matter a whole lot. It's more growing conditions.
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to that one.
Yeah.
Okay, so going back to our tools in the next 5 minutes that we have, we talked about shovels. Do you look for the same thing in a hoe?
Definitely, there's hoes that are like welded, where it'll have like the hook that comes out of the handle, and then the flat blade part of your hoe is like welded onto that. Those are the ones that I avoid.
Yeah.
So those are the ones that break really easily.
And it seems like those are the ones that always come out.
Yeah, yeah. So you want a solid shank hoe that's just forged out of, again, one solid piece of steel. There's no joints, there's no welds or anything on it. And of course, some handles are better than others. You've got one that's just forced in with a ferrule over the top of it, or one that has like a rivet where it actually goes through a hole inside the head. Those tend to hold up the longest. So watch for ones that are riveted and not welded onto the head. So
when I think of tools that I absolutely have to have and can't be without, a shovel's one. A hoe
gotta
I use
hoe.
Even more than a shovel.
Gotta have a hoe.
And then there's my weeder tool that I just love to weed with because it gets all those red roots in on the push and the pole stroke.
Yeah, so you got like a stirrup hoe.
Yeah.
Yeah, stirrup hoes are great. I'd have to say we use a stirrup hoe a ton. Of course, you got to have a shovel. I use an onion hoe, and it's a smaller hoe. It's a thinner blade, so it's maybe 8 inches, 10 inches long, but it's only 2 inches wide, and or tall. I guess not wide, but it'd be 2 inches tall, and you can sharpen the edges on three sides, and so you can actually use the narrow 2-inch side or the 8-inch or 9-inch wide side to hoe with, and it's easy to get in around the plants if you turn it on the edge, and it's a great tool. Where some of the other ones are like big, grubbing hoes, those great big huge things. You almost end up moving more dirt with those than you do weeds. Yeah.
Let's see. And then as far as what other tools, what other things would you...
Got to have a hand pruner. So a hand pruner is almost essential, and a lopper. If you have any trees or shrubs or anything, you got to have a lopper and a hand pruner. Almost can't survive without those. And I'm trying to think what else was just kind of a rake, good tooth, heavy tine metal rake would be good, and a leaf rake.
So, a big leaf rake.
A big leaf rake, yeah.
I don't know. Maybe they won't last as long, but I love those big plastic 30-inch ones. Boy, you can sure rake up a lot.
That's a good rake, yeah. We sell mostly 24s, but the 30s are kind of nice. You can cover a larger area with them. So those are good. I'd have to say those are like all the essential tools. There's a couple smaller hand tools that are kind of nice to have, but you can pretty much do everything with the
pruning
five or
saw.
Six that we mentioned. Yeah,
I saw. Love my pruning saw.
You
got
to have a saw. Yeah. Did you get one of the Baco ones? Yeah, the Baco ones are amazing. They are truly amazing. So yeah, a saw, a hand pruner, a lopper for tree maintenance and shrub maintenance. And then, you know, for in the garden, you got to have a shovel, a rake, and a hoe for sure. But I love those stirrup hoes. Those are sweet.
Now, with your hand pruners, how do you... Mine is getting a little dull, so how do you sharpen those?
I've actually got a little tool that you can just keep in your back pocket. You can just keep a nice edge on your pruner with all the time. And you do about 5 to 10 strokes on the top part of the blade, and you flip it over and you do 3 to 5 on the back side, then just kind of alternate until you get a nice edge put on it.
Is that a Bocco?
It's a steel. Yeah, it's a Bocco steel.
I got two of those for Christmas.
Oh, they are awesome. I use mine all the time. So, you know, when I'm pruning our roses when they come in, and we'll get 500, 600 roses in at a time, and I can prune all day with the same pruner, and my hand doesn't get tired because I got the rotating handle. But I'll just every now and then just stop and just put an edge back on it, just keep that edge on there, and just cut so clean and nice. And if you can maintain that edge, you really don't have to worry about having, you know, a big file or a grinder or anything to maintain it with. But if you get it notched, you know, if you like cut something that's really hard or end up cutting something you didn't realize there was a piece of wire or something in there, and you kind of notch the blade a little bit, then you got to get the file out, you know, and clean that up. But I sharpen a lot of pruners for people too. So if you have some pruners and you just don't feel comfortable sharpening them, you know, bring them in. I can take care of that for you. So
what service?
Yeah, it's not too difficult if you know what you're doing. I've cut myself on multiple occasions with people's stuff after I've sharpened them. So they're pretty
kind of like someone who cuts hair and end up having little.
Yeah, they're pretty darn sharp. So when I'm finished with them,
I learned pretty quick after I bought a really good pruning saw. Don't leave that blade open.
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Well, we've reached the end of our time. Mark, thanks for coming in.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Brian.
You've been listening to Access Utah. Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden in Logan has been my guest. Thank you for joining us on this edition of Access Utah.
Enjoy the beauty and fragrance of roses without all the work. Many of us have switched to hardier, more pest-resistant shrub roses for just that reason. But now, thanks to the Earthkind Rose designation, growing roses will be easier for all. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. The goal of this program was to help gardeners enjoy roses while limiting the use of fertilizers, pesticides, and water. The Texas AgriLife Extension Service started the program by conducting field trials of 100 rose cultivars for at least 4 years. They evaluated the roses for outstanding performance, superior pest resistance, and tolerance of a wide variety of soils, from acid to alkaline and sand to clay. To earn the Earthkind designation, roses also needed good heat and drought tolerance once established. The effort has expanded, and now the National Earthkind Rose Research Study includes test sites throughout the United States and several countries. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.